You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on
KISO 88.7
Avalon.
This is Ron Trupa with Catalina Film Radio. We're showing the movie Nesting this Saturday, November 10th, at the Hotel Metropole Conference Room at 7 p.m. This interview is with director, producer, and writer John Childenko for the movie Nesting. And you can hear a little bit about the behind the scenes of filmmaking with this film and some of his other projects, and then come out and see Nesting for yourself. Enjoy the interview.
Hello, Avalon. You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on Avalon's KISL 88.7 FM. My name is Ron Trupa, and my guest today is a friend of our Catalina Film Festival family, and now he's becoming a friend of our Catalina Film Society family. His name is John Childenko, and he is the writer-director of Nesting, which actually played at the film festival this year. John, how are you?
Ron, I'm doing really well. Thanks so much for having me, for talking with me.
Oh, no problem. I mean, you know, we really appreciate good filmmakers and good films, and we're excited not only to have you in our film festival, but to actually have you on the Film Society roster. We have a lot of really cool film enthusiasts that go to the Film Society every month, so, you know, it's always a challenge to go, okay, what great piece of work can we bring to them this month? You know, we're like, seriously. So, you know, we're looking through the catalog of you know, pre-filtered, screened, they're qualified for our festival, and Nesting was up there, and we're like, let's call John and let's see if we can make this work.
Fantastic, man. You know, it's it doesn't surprise me there are so many film enthusiasts there. I had such a great time at the festival, and, you know, I've been to either with a movie or, you know, doing business, I've been to pretty much every major film festival out there. I mean, I had a film at Sundance, and then we brought Nesting to a bunch of film festivals, and you know, Tribeca, and, you know, had a movie at South By, so all of them. And, you know, there's a really, everybody's got, each one has their own different personality. And the great thing about Catalina was everything is pretty much walkable. So you have this more, it builds more of a community, I think. You see people walking to and from the different, the screenings, and you get to talk to them at the different parties and say, hey, what did you like, what you didn't like, you know, how did you feel about certain movies? And it really creates a kind of a community, a sense of that you're building something really special.
Dan, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. When we started it, we looked at film festivals that were similar in size, for the size of the city, and Telluride was up on the list. It's kind of like a little Avalon on top of a mountain. And, you know, so I mean, we saw stuff like that we really liked, and the quaint, you know, feeling that you get just like what you said. So it's awesome that carries over, and that's exactly what, you know.
Telluride's one that I never miss. I've been going for over 10 years now, and that's what I thought, because you're up in that mountain community, and you pass people, and you're like, oh, yeah, I saw you last year. Would you like this time? And you really get that sense of family, kind of. And, you know, I was really excited to screen at Catalina, and it was actually my first time going to the island. And I saw the lineup, and I saw the screening. I think we were at an early morning screening right after the opening night movie. So I'm thinking, oh man, this is going to be interesting. Everybody's going to be sleeping from seeing the Avengers. But it showed up, and there's a great turnout. And what was really cool, man, like it was one of the most special screenings we had for the movie. So I show up, and we get there early, and the film preservation people brought a special kind of tribute reel of very early films that were shot in San Francisco.
And Genesis, and then we had Trip Down Market Street in San Francisco.
Exactly, right? So it's some of the first film that's ever gone through a motion picture camera, basically. You know what I mean? There were other documentaries of before, but this is like film history. Couple that with the fact that we're in this amazing venue, you know, which I think was the first theater built for sound. Island, where the first narrative motion picture was made, right? Because they screened that, right? Wasn't it the first?
Well, it was the centennial for the first narrative on the island, not the first narrative in the world, but
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the first one on the island. So you're on this island with a special connection to film. You're in this theater with such a special history, you know, in the motion picture art form. And then you see these great movies that have come before, and then they screen my movie, and you feel like you're real. I, you know, on a personal level, I felt like I was really part of something special. you know, that this is the history of filmmaking, and people that have made movies and will continue to make movies forever, it's all, you feel like you're part of something. And it was a real strange feeling. I remember sitting back in the audience watching and really having that feeling wash over me. Wow, this is a real special screening. And I still remember that, you know, I'll never forget that.
John, you completely gave me goosebumps right now. I'm not kidding. I mean, that's, you know, that's, it's great. It's really great to hear it. That's, you know, the team that we have has so much love and passion for the island and so much for the history of film on the island. So to hear you say that, you know, kind of brings all those countless sleepless nights that we spend putting together to celebrate that sort of to light. And thank you for that. That's awesome. It's great to hear.
It's true. I hope to come back, man. It was just a great time.
Any shots from nesting on location?
Did I shoot on location? What do you mean?
Around it. Well, I mean, just in general. I mean, well, the D.W. Griffith film that you saw is actually kind of where the phrase on location was coined by D.W. Griffith. Because
right.
He actually went to Catalina and shot somewhere else besides where you're standing. And
right. So
he's like, we're going to go shoot on location. And that's kind of where that all became
nice.
The phrase.
You're part
of that history.
Yeah. Because of...
You showed it on location.
Exactly, we showed it on location. And we kind of did. We because of time and budget constraints, I needed to keep the movie pretty neighborhood-based to the east side of Los Angeles, Silver Lake and Los Feliz and Atwater and Echo Park. But we did, there were some limitations for the mall sequences. The shopping mall that we found was in Torrance. So we had to trek out there and do that, which was really fun. I think whoever my location manager, whoever he spoke with, I think he convinced him that we were a really small production, that we had like a couple, you know, handheld, you know, SLR cameras. So they were like, yeah, sure, come, you know, so you'll spend the day here. I don't think he realized that we were laying down, you know, dolly track in the food court at lunch hour.
Someone got fired that day.
But you can't beat that kind of production value.
Especially with locations like that, because, I mean, are you saying you didn't rent it? You just kind of got a favor and
no,
they thought you were going to be small?
You can't do that. But we did have permits and everything. But, you know, it's one of those things I made a decision early on to put – all the money we had on screen, you know, it's stuff that you actually see in the picture. So, you know, locations and production design, and if we had to build some stuff, I wanted it to look as good as it possibly could because, you know, the movie is a comedy. It's a romantic comedy, and people are used to seeing romantic comedies that have a certain production value, you know, and I needed to, and that was sort of where the bar was. So visually, I needed to preserve that. So we got a lot of mileage out of locations like the mall, and we shot in a bunch of you know, concert venues and nightclubs and things like that.
Well, you know, it does look beautiful. I mean, you know, production value is huge, especially being on the other end from a film festival's point of view. We see so much stuff that, you know, sometimes acting will transcend production value. Sometimes cinematography is amazing and the production value looks so amazing, and then all of a sudden the acting is like really subpar and you're like, oh my god, it looked so good, why did they do that? And you know, I mean, we see so many different smorgasbord grab bag sort of films that come in where they're so like high up on one part of the filmmaking spectrum and then they're so low on the other that it's kind of a mixed bag of nuts. So for us, is when we're programming, our program director Ziggy, she does an amazing job with, you know, getting certain films. When we saw Nesting, the production value really stuck with us from like the first shot, and then we're like, oh great, let it hold, and it did. I mean, it held all the way through because you can see it's a quality film.
Cool. Thanks. Really kind to hear, man.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, and I think it's I think that's carrying through. We got we did a 10 city nationwide theatrical release, and then a real strong you know, video on demand component of that too. So and I think it hits I think in December it'll be on you know, DVD and all that kind of stuff. So. Yeah.
Great. So you're going to release on DVD next month, right in time for Christmas and the holidays? And
pick up five.
You're smart. It's a family film.
You got it. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's what, actually one thing that I really wanted to try to bring it in. To PG-13 rating. Not that, people under 17 are really seeing romantic comedies about 30-something Gen Xers. But you never know. A lot of people sort of just see. They just don't go see our movies. So that was the whole rating process is a whole other can of worms, as they say.
Well, okay. So now you started off. And I'm sure you started off before this, but you started off with Fake Stacy, and that was that your directorial debut with the short film?
That was my short. I had done some.
At least I see on IMDb, which doesn't usually have the most complete credit.
You gotta watch that. I started out with some commercials and music videos in the very beginning, and then wanted to make my first short. So we did Fake Stacy with my with a writing partner, Sean Blythe, and. That was great. I think we shot, I think it was 5 days and maybe one little pickup day. Larry King has a cameo in that, so we had to work around his schedule. And we went and shot that, but that was, that was back in the day before, we were testing out different cameras, and digital technology just didn't have the aesthetic yet. It didn't look good enough. It's not what I wanted to make. So we shot all that on 35.
Wow.
So I know it was, as far as short films go, nowadays you make a budget, I think we, 20 some thousand, would seem really high for a short film, especially of that kind of, with that kind of subject. But that back then, if you wanted to shoot on film, that's what you had to do,
And it had a great run. It was official selection at Sundance, Tribeca, South by Southwest, and Hamptons.
Yeah.
As I see on the poster.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, those are big festivals. They don't usually play around when they're picking their selections.
Yeah, it's great. And the fun thing is, what y'all are building is, you keep in touch with those people. I remember, the people in my class, my year at Sundance, it was great that you Primer, premiered there. So, I got to hang out with those guys, and we're still, we still keep in touch. And Morgan Spurlock brought Super Size Me that year.
It was
great. Yeah, it was just really fun to hang out with that fun.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio on KISL 88.7 Avalon.
This is Ron Trupa with Catalina Film Radio. Today's director, writer, producer interview is with John Childenko. He is the man behind the movie Nesting that we will be showing this Saturday at the Hotel Metropole Conference Room at 7 p.m. for the Catalina Film Society. So come out and enjoy the rest of the interview.
So now where did you go from there? Because I see, again, from IMDb, that you kind of didn't write your own thing until Nesting. Is that true? Or were you writing other things before that?
There's some stuff. There's some omissions there. We've got we had a few projects in development sort of in between there, and ensemble sort of sad story told in a funny way. And it was so hard to do what's called packaging. I don't know how many people are familiar with the way that kind of the business side of things works, but
I don't think the audience is. But if you want to shed some light,
packaging is basically you're putting the pieces together. You're getting your budget in place. You're getting your actors lined up and everything. And because it was an ensemble movie, it was really hard to get all the actors in place. You get these two big stars attached, and you're like, great, hang on, I need three more. So you go out try to find somebody who's going to work creatively, visually or cast wise or even age wise, whatever, with the co-stars, and somebody goes off and gets a TV show. You're like, oh, now I got to replace that role, and then you get another couple, and somebody goes. So it was like herding cats. It was really, really difficult to put all the pieces together. So, when I thought about a next project, I was like, listen, two leads, I could put the money together, I could shoot it, with a small crew in the neighborhood and get it going. And that was, a lot of the sort of impetus for a movie like Nesting, of that kind of scope.
Okay, so now this begs the question. Your inspiration. What was the organic matter? What was the genesis of how this started?
Yeah. Well, I thought it was a kind of almost an underserved demographic. You think about, everybody talks about the millennials. you know, the social media generation. And then of course, you know, you got the baby boomers, who can't stop talking about themselves, right? So,
right.
But in between there, you got this Generation X thing, which in the 90s, everybody was talking about them. You know, these are all the, you know, Nirvana listening, flannel wearing people and the whole slacker culture and stuff. But then that dissipated, you know, and nobody really heard from them. So I was thinking about, well, whatever happened to that generation? And I kind of know as being part of that. Well, you know, you grow up, you get jobs, and you end up at Pottery Barn, you know, like furnishing
right.
your home or your apartment or whatever. And it was funny to see that kind of, that youthful enthusiasm going out to shows and sort of anti-establishment attitudes or what have you. And that shift between the same people who were out doing all that stuff are now, you know, looking through the Restoration Hardware catalog, you know, and buying, you know, nesting tables and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Booking.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting, you know, that was sort of an interesting life stage to deal with. And we started from there and thinking, well, okay, like what if you completely rejected that? What happens if you had this place that you had built and it wasn't doing the trick? You know, of course, stuff doesn't make us happy. You know, I mean, you think it does, but it doesn't. So, you know, what happens if you rejected all that and then went back to where you started from to try to recapture your, who you were in your 20s?
Yeah, and if people don't know, and they probably don't until they see it, what the movie's about, I'll just read the quick synopsis. When a 30-something couple set aside the home, decide to rekindle their relationship, they return to their old neighborhood and end up squatting illegally in their 20-something lives.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting,
yeah.
You know, kind of approach to a film. And did you know anybody personally who did this?
No, thankfully no. I would probably be in jail now. But it was about, you know, okay. what about the theory, you know, can you go home again? I mean, you know, of course you can't, but what if you could? And what if your old home was vacant, and what if you decided to break in, you know, and try
right.
to recapture your youth in a very literal sense.
Yeah, and I don't want to give anything away for people that are going to see the film, but and if you've already seen it at the film festival and you already know, but I'm surprised they didn't get into more trouble than they did.
Well, you know, yeah, they have to rely on their grown-up skills to try to get them out of this mess, so.
Yeah, no, it was sweet. It's sweet. I mean, you definitely have, your finger on the pulse of humanity because you know, with the craziness of it all too, you also have a lot of really good, you know, sentimental moments where just really part of a relationship and the truthfulness of it, and that definitely, I believe, comes from you. Although Sean is credited as a writer, it's got a occasionally funny aside by in the text.
I don't know what that
means exactly, but
we were trying to figure that out. Sean and I have been working together for years, and we did Fake Safety together. And you know, I think everybody, you know, in a creative sense sort of needs somebody you can send stuff to that's in early stages that you know we're going to give you honest opinions. So there were a couple scenes that were, you know, kind of punched up, or hey, why don't you think of it this way, or you know, how about this joke here? So it always helps to have that kind of support system, you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's great. What did you guys shoot the film on?
We shot it on the RED camera, so it was we did it digitally on the RED system. So and all on prime lenses too. I don't want to get too inside baseball, but as opposed to zooms, primes, you know, with some exceptions, you know, offer a really nice image quality.
Right.
Yeah, RED cameras with primes. And then we used actually the Canon system, a 5D, as a backup camera if I needed extra coverage, or some of the montage scenes were done with the Canon, and some of our, we shot in 18 days, we had one pickup day that we didn't have our main cameras for. Those all had to be returned. So, so we shot with the Canon. And I think it matters.
I didn't notice it switching up. So, I mean, you must have done a good job. Did you have, like, a whole lens kit package that went on the Canon and everything?
Yeah, we used the Zeiss package. But before we even started, I did a bunch of camera tests. So we shot test footage with a few different platforms. Because it's one thing when you see it, you know, in an edit bay, it's completely different when you see it on the big screen. So I needed to shoot the footage. And then have it projected, at a post-production facility to really see how things are going to hold up. And that was how we made the decision about the format to shoot the film.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's good. See, a lot of people, they don't know all what goes in behind the scenes. But, I mean, the Canons are really amazing. They are really,
you know, and for you know, for the price yourself and have it home, it's fantastic. You know, but every tool has limitations. I don't think there's any camera system that's like, oh, this is absolutely perfect. You know, everything has limitations.
Sure.
So,
but I think when you get the Red, you expect the Red to be a great camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when people see a semi-professional like a Canon,
mm-hmm.
they just hope it looks good, you know.
Yeah.
But really,
yeah.
it's bumped up almost to the professional level, even on television.
Yeah, you know, they are using it for a lot of TV shows. And I think, to me, the big thing, yeah, definitely there's some image quality things. There are other technical issues. But if you need one, like if you have to get into a tight space, if you have to shoot and not draw attention to yourself for documentaries, there are
sure.
times that's the only thing I would bring in. You know,
are you talking about guerrilla filmmaking, John?
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
no
yeah,
permits.
You know, there are some shots in that movie that were that had to be a little incognito.
That's funny. We won't tell them which ones.
Mm-hmm.
Let the lawyers figure that out. So the casting, how did you you have great two lead actors in Todd and Allie.
Right.
What was your process?
Well, we had a great casting director. Hannah Cooper came on board, and she'd done a ton of TV and some independent films as well. And so we started the process, I wanted people. You sort of go a lot of times in the casting process. It almost works like a workshopping session because, you know, if you hadn't done table reads, this is the first time you're hearing your words spoken by actors, right? So these people come in and, you know, and they're reading and we're working out scenes, and I'm spending a lot of time with all these actors because I'm trying to figure out what works and what doesn't, you know? So it was really fun. And you have a few people come in and you're like, wow, they've really brought that to life, or that's a take on this line or a rhythm of this joke that I hadn't thought of before, but that really works. So you're making notes through the whole process. But, Allie came in and just really lit up the room. It was really special. And then Todd came in, and I think we saw Todd maybe like the day before. And there was, I mean, you know, they come in, read it a few times, we shook hands, and then he leaves, and everybody in the room was like, okay, that's, you know, there you go. There's our guy. You know, it was just really special, you know, for both of them, and you know, for all the leads, really. And in fact, a lot of them came in to read for other parts, and then I ended up saying, hey, let me give you this part of the script. Would you go outside and prepare for it and come back and read for this other role? Because you look at somebody on paper in a headshot or photograph, and when they come in, you're like, oh, you know what? There's this other role that you'd be great for. So you juggle things around.
And then
Kevin Linehan, who plays Graham, our main character's best friend and really sort of terrible lawyer.
Right.
He came in to read for a smaller role, for one of the supporting roles, and just nailed it. And that was one of the examples where I'm like, hey, listen, you know, I've got this bigger role. I think you'd be great for it. Would you have a look and come back? And he did, and it worked out really well, I think.
That's you can actually see that in, because you have so much invested with, you know, writing, producing, directing that you really can see what you want out of those characters when the actors walk in. And that's a note to all the actors as well. Whenever you see a casting call with the writer, director, producer that's doing the film, go, because, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot more control just in past
exactly.
experience, you know. If you say, let's rewrite the role from a pothead smoking person to a guy in a suit and tie because you like the actor,
yeah.
that role gets changed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always good. I actually really enjoy the casting process. I know, you know, some people just kind of sit at the table in the back and, you know, check their emails. But I think it's great. Like I said before, I think it's a great opportunity to work with actors, and I think it's a great opportunity to play with different things and discover things about the material that maybe you hadn't seen before.
You're listening to Catalina Film Radio.
KISL
88.7
Avalon. This is Ron Trupa with Catalina Film Radio. Today's director, writer, producer interview is with John Childenko. He is the man behind the movie Nesting that we will be showing this Saturday at the Hotel Metropole Conference Room at 7 p.m. for the Catalina Film Society. So come out and enjoy the rest of the interview.
Did you have a lot of rehearsal?
Absolutely not. It was so
really?
Last minute. Oh, my gosh. It was so last minute. I mean, we had We had gone through the casting process, and by the time we actually finalized everything, it was 1 or 2 days before wardrobe, and then the next day we started shooting. I mean, it was really, really fast. Yeah.
So you really did have some great actors. They came prepared.
Wait, what's that?
They came prepared then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I remember seeing, I was going through, we were doing the DVD commentary, and I was going through some old emails, and I got, you know, I saw some from Todd and Allie saying, like, okay, what pages are we shooting? And, you know, I'm reading the script more, and they were just, like, you know, questions that we had, just trying to work it out before we started shooting. But I think that, you know, I think that adds a little something. Yeah, I think it's nice. It adds maybe a little bit of freshness, and you have to bring your own personal experience, I think, as an actor to the material that way, and that can offer some really unexpected, fun kind of some elements.
I think so too. I think there's always more of a real energy in people's performances. You know, there's the famous stories about Marlon Brando as well, how even towards the end of his career, everything was in an ear prompter for him, and he didn't even want to know the lines until someone read them to him in his ear. And there's something to that natural rawness that makes people kind of, and you know, you connect with your character, so hats off to you. I mean, you know, that's, you know, having a director that either gives you that freedom or that understands the moments is really important. So it definitely shows on camera. And it looks like you had a Martin Scorsese moment yourself, as there's a character called Sound Guy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I believe it was in a club.
It was, and it was actually out of necessity. I think, I can't what it was either we had forgotten to cast that, or I thought it was just going to grab a friend. And then it was our last day. It was our last full day of shooting. And we needed somebody to be in the soundboard. I said, all right, I'll just go do it. And actually I had a line. I think I cut my own line out of the movie.
I think you have a line. I think I remember you with the line.
Yeah, do I have a little something?
Unless you cut it out of the DVD.
I guess it's in there. Maybe it's just like a little, like, nod.
He comes up to you at the booth, and then he kind of says something, like, up on stage or something.
Yeah, something like that. But it used to be longer. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I only know what I saw. I don't know what was cut.
man.
No, it's good. It's good to see you really, you know, integrated in your work. I mean, it means you care.
Location-wise, man, their grown-up house is my house. We shot here for, I think, 3 days or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the story behind that was, you know, we needed a house to be their grown-up house before they go out on their trip and find their old apartment. So we scouted a couple places, but, yeah, when you make these decisions, these financial decisions, and I could use that money for, you know, for catering for everybody, or use it for, you know, another location that we wanted to get, or, you know, whatever it was, you know, rent the camera for an extra day or something. So, my wife was, I think, 8 months pregnant, 7 or 8 months pregnant at the time we were filming. And, you know, listen, honey, I need a favor. We're going to shoot here for a couple days. So we shot in my dining room.
She wanted to kill you.
Yeah, it was, you know, she was actually really okay with it. She realized how important it was and that kind of thing. She was totally okay with it. We shoot kitchen, dining room stuff for a couple of days. The only one time the kind of mama bear instincts kicked in was she came home, and our DIT tech, basically the guy that takes the digital footage and converts it into something you can edit with, right? They need to be on set to kind of make sure everything doesn't get lost and things like that. So he set up his little station, which is like a little, you know, a little stool and a laptop and a stack of hard drives, right? He sets his system up in the baby's room, okay? And my wife comes home and she sees this guy, you know, shorts and the flannel kind of jacket, the tech guys kind of wear. She sees him all set up in the baby's room, and that was the only kind of breaking point. That was the, you know, mama bear instincts kicked in. She's like, who is this man in my daughter's room? So that was the time where it got a little bit hairy, but yeah, all in all.
And, you know, emotions and hormones are a little bit sensitive at that time, too. So you're lucky you got out of that alive.
I know, right?
That was pretty risky.
Yeah, but it worked out well. We really shot the heck out of this house. Yeah, the kitchen, the dining room, the bedroom, I think the backyard.
That's awesome. Now, you had a really good marketing package. I think we got your film originally from PMK. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're fantastic. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, anybody with a with an independent film that needs a partner in the you know, the marketing and publicity and promotions department. I can't speak highly enough you know, to those that team over there. They're fantastic.
Yeah, and they really pushed you. I mean, I think we almost had your premiere, and then you went a couple days early at the Newport Beach Film Festival.
Yeah, we did Newport. We tried to we pushed everything to use the film festivals as to help with the push for the theatrical release. You know, sort of build some
sure.
festivals and then lead right in, because we came out. So it was March, and then we came out in May 11th, and I think came before our theatrical release.
Right.
Right. You guys were.
Yeah.
You guys were.
Yeah. We were May. I think you were on. We were May 5th through the 7th.
Yeah,
so
okay,
you were on.
Yeah.
I think
so
May
6th. Before. Yeah.
Yeah.
That worked out really well.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, it was just great having you and you know, making sure. We wanted your film to be in the big theater, because obviously not all the features could be in that theater.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
It was fantastic. And you remember the, opening night, and, you know, Stan Lee's there, and he's, when Avengers was like at 11 o'clock or something like that, and he's up there introducing the movie.
Yeah.
He stayed through the whole movie. You know, it was fantastic, man.
He didn't, but we could have people think he did.
In my mind, he was there.
He's seen it before.
Yeah, right.
But Stanley was there the entire movie.
I saw him on the red carpet, right? I think I'd done the press right before, and he's got that great voice, you know? Okay, we're
yeah.
going to do this interview now. I'm thinking, like, man, I wonder...
How are you? I'm from New York.
I kind of wanted to ask him to record my voicemail message. You know, John's
not that would have been awesome.
He's out fighting crime, but he'll leave a message and he'll call you back. Man, that'd be great.
He would have totally done that, too.
This is Stan Lee. This is John's phone. Leave him a message. What else are you going to do?
I'm sure it would have sounded something like that.
Yeah.
he tends to joke.
Right.
But he's got so much energy. He's amazing for being 90
yeah.
years old next month.
Yeah, it was inspiring. It was just great. It was great. And, you know, and it's really great to see so many of those properties over the last, 10 years or so really reach a new audience through all these amazing films. You know, I mean, eventually
yeah.
it was incredible, right?
Yeah, and they definitely built it up. And, you know, Stan makes this famous cameo in all of his films.
Right.
And, it was great. We loved having him. You know, it was one of those things that was just special. The opening night of the Avengers with Stan Lee, which became the biggest movie in the world.
Mm.
And at the time, we didn't know that. We just knew we were going to have the creator there. So
yeah.
It was, it's an exciting way to – it's kind of fun running film festivals when it comes down to that stuff. All the work before that, you know, you're not sleeping much.
Oh, man, yeah, setting up sponsors and planning all the events, and I can only imagine that. Only imagine.
Yeah, it's a good 9 months of not sleeping. Sort of like what your wife went through, and then you have
that's a lot like having a baby.
Yeah. So what's next for you, John? What are you working on? I mean, this was a pretty successful run for you, right?
Yeah, it's been great, man, and I'm hoping to keep it going. I've got, you know, a couple other movies in the pipeline in different stages, either written or almost written. But I'm in production right now on a documentary, on my first feature documentary. So that's we're I don't know, maybe 25% of the way on that one. So that's really exciting.
Great. Can you say what it is, or is it a surprise?
No, I think I can. It's I've uncovered the secret album collection at the White House. So it's the record collection curated by back in the 70s for the personal use of the president and the first family.
No way. The current president or the history of the presidencies?
It's for the White House. It's the record library at the White House. So for all the presidents that that choose to enjoy it. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. There's
that's fascinating.
Yeah, man, it's great. You know, and, it was curated by some of the best and brightest minds that you know in the music industry to choose. Hey, these are really important recordings that should go in this library. There's a book library up there, and they decided that hey, you know, if there's books, there should also be music. So it's incredible, man. It's about 2,000 records. I mean, you've got. Evolved, you know, classical and jazz and spoken word and poetry, and then you, of course, the popular section, the rock and roll section. You've got, you know, a bunch of Dylan, Springsteen's in there. The Stones, the first Clash record is in there. You know,
oh
first, Joni Mitchell and Astral Weeks and Who's Next. You know, it's just really this incredible treasure, really, of
So is it like a Library of Congress sort of archive, or is it just, was it intended for the presidents
to listen to? It's intended for the president. It's up there, it's up there in the, or it was up there in the residence. It was put in storage, and that's what was kind of interesting. It was put in storage in 1980, and no one had seen or heard about it since until I uncovered it. So,
how did you find out about it?
You know, I'd heard stories about it just being a music fan, you know, and that kind of thing. And then after Nesting, I'd always sort of kept a little note card, you know, on my corkboard in my office, and I was thinking about, you know, another project I could get going quickly and do it, you know, on a limited budget with a limited crew. And
sure.
I said, hey, man, I bet I could get this thing going. So, I made a few phone calls and locked everything up. And, yeah, pretty.
So have you gone to the White House, or will you be going to the White House?
I did. I went over there, and they pulled out a storage for me and photographed it with a
How cool.
crew. And I brought some of the people, you know, a lot of the people who were on these initial commissions are no longer around. But I brought some of the people who were still around. And brought them back to see the records, back to visit their old friends. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
Were any of them autographed from the artist when they would visit?
No. It's really just you know, like a personal record collection.
Just personal.
Yeah. They went after they selected the records. They went to reach out to all the record labels to try to fulfill, to try to actually get the copies of everything. But they are pristine vinyl copies of these records. I mean,
That's amazing.
You know, I've probably seen 24 copies of Who's Next or something at record stores all over the world, you know, but I've never seen, it's like walking into a record store in 1978. You know, like everything is perfect, you know, which is really kind of wild. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating, man. I can't wait to see that. So hopefully in the next year or so.
Yeah.
It'll be out.
Maybe, you know, depending on the timing, maybe we could bring it to Catalina. Hey.
That would be great. Our film festival is going to be September next year.
Right,
so
cool.
It's quite possible.
Neat.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. We look forward to showing the Film Society Enthusiasts Nesting this Saturday. It's going to be at the Hotel Metropole, where you stayed there.
I stayed there during the festival. It's a fantastic place and a really, you know, kind, generous staff. If anyone is there for the screening, I think I left my phone charger upstairs in the room. So if you could bring that back, that'd be great. That would really be helpful for me.
You know, if you call the front desk, they actually might still have it.
Okay.
You never know. John Shuldenko, thank you so much. We got his film, Nesting. It's Saturday night at the Hotel Metropole Conference Room, 7 p.m. And we look forward to all your future work, sir.
All right. Thanks, Ron. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
This is Ron Trupa with Catalina Film Radio. We're showing the movie Nesting this Saturday, November 10th. At the Hotel Metropole Conference Room at 7 p.m. Come out and see Nesting for yourself.
Catalina Film Radio.
KISL.
88.7. Avalon.